sort of worked out a logic to the sequence of things. There probably is one. But sometimes with these Abhidhamma texts, nobody really knows anymore what the why it came out as it did. Often they start with a corpus of members of a list, and then that gets expanded. So by the time centuries have gone by, you don't really know what it was originally. Although this is fairly well attested from a number of different sources, so that we're probably fairly close to what Asanga actually wrote. So number 8, that's on page 7. It's the whole of page 7, and it's a little bit on the next page. Furthermore, the Bodhisattva, with the ethics of mental compliance, complies with the expectations of sentient beings. This is a very unsatisfactory translation. It sounds like he's a real, you know, what's the word for it? Flatterer, you know what I mean? He just does what people want. It's not what it means at all. The Sanskrit is Chittanuvartana. Shilena. Chitta is mind, consciousness, awareness. Vartana is connected with our own word versari, well, not our word, but the Latin word, as in reverse, obverse, and so forth. It means turning towards. So chittanu vartana means turning the mind towards. Turning the mind towards beings, in other words, and towards particular beings, which comes to mean then something perhaps more like empathy. That would probably be the best word for it from our current usage. The Bodhisattva understands beings through empathy, feels a connection with them. And not just a general connection, but a specific one. And it's not an intellectually worked out connection. It's an immediate sensed one, felt one. Empathy in that sense. He knows the dispositions, the nature, and the elements of sentient beings. So he empathizes with each being and understands, as we would say, where they're coming from, how they see things, what they're like, what matters to them, what their capacities are, what their natures are. Because every individual has their own particular character, their own particular nature, their own particular disposition, their own interests, their own concerns. You know, very simple things like some people, they come into a room, they immediately see the colours, some people will see the shape, some people's eyes will immediately go to the image. Everybody will perceive the room in slightly different ways, with slightly different emphases. Some people will like some things and dislike some things. Different people respond to different things in the environment. In what I'm talking about over these few days, some of you will have responded to some things, some of you will have responded to other things. Some of you will have taken certain things in a certain way, others will have taken the same thing in a slightly different way. We're all different, we're all a bundle of conditions, a different bundle of conditions with very different background and circumstances and so forth, and just different characters, some more intellectually inclined, some more emotionally inclined, and so on and so forth. So the Bodhisattva learns to tune in to people. That's perhaps the best way you could put it. Chittanuvartana means tuning in, mentally tuning in. So sort of picking up on people. If you like, even at the deepest level, picking up on their energy. You know, sometimes if you're very, very sensitive, if you're doing a lot of meditation, you can sort of feel people's energy. Sometimes I felt that anyway. And you can sort of feel the energy in the world around you, feel the life in the world around you. And I'm using a metaphor. I hope you understand what I mean. It's not something thought. It's not even something perceived, it's something felt quite directly, a sense of the other person. So the Bodhisattva tunes in really deeply to other people and knows where they're coming from, what they're capable of, in a way you could say even what their next step is. Quite interesting, it's said that on the eve of enlightenment, the Buddha had a perception, first of all, of his many, many lifetimes. And then he perceived beings arising and passing away and proceeding on to new lives in accordance with their different karmic, their different karma and their own dispositions. So he saw the whole of living reality as beings flowing along in accordance with their own character and disposition and actions and so forth. And this is just before he finally awakens. Indeed, it's part of his complete awakening, one of the abhinyas, the higher knowledges. So that the Bodhisattva has this sort of capacity to tune in, to other people's characters. I sometimes find this with Bhante. If I go to see him, I'll have something to talk about, but he doesn't seem to want to talk about what I want to talk about. It's infuriating. But he starts talking about something, and sometimes I realize that he's picked up on something that I wasn't even fully aware of. Particularly striking because the last few years, his sight is not very good at all. So you often get the feeling these sort of eyes that are seeing you but not seeing you, because it really described to me that the macular degeneration means that his field of vision sort of bows out like a fairground mirror. You know, those sort of things that distort your perception. So he's sort of looking at you like that. And you're obviously, I'm distributed around the edges of his perception. But at the same time, you feel he's taking you in absolutely fully and somehow tuning into you in a way that you're not even always tuned in yourself. So the Bodhisattva is tuning into people. He doesn't go with his own idea about them. Oh, they're from this background, they're like that. That this colour, that shape, this gender. He just tunes into them as they are and then responds to them. And this empathy means that he's very, very sensitive, or she is very, very sensitive to the to the state of beings. And whatever the Bodhisattva does should enhance that state, not harm it. So the Bodhisattva is so deeply tuned in that he or she acts in such a way that it leads them to greater awareness, greater happiness, greater fulfillment, leads them on the path, or at the best, at least puts them into a better state of mind, if you like. At the worst, rather, puts them into a better state of mind. Avoids doing things or saying things that are unpleasant, that grate or jar, unless that grating or jarring is beneficial. Because sometimes, don't use this as an excuse, sometimes it's useful to the person to hear something that's not pleasant for them to hear. Sometimes, you know, you've probably experienced it yourself. You know at times you have to say something painful, either just a painful fact. You know, I've a number of times been the harbinger of very bad news, and you really don't want to do it because you know how it's going to be, but you have to do it. Because in the long run, they need to face up to it. Sometimes you need to tell some people about their own behaviour, something about their own action that they don't want to hear. But you know that if you tell them, it will be to their benefit. You don't do it trying to harm. You do it knowing that it will not be pleasant to hear. but you do it in a way that is most digestible and helps the person most. If you don't have to do that, you don't do it. You try to benefit the other through your presence with them. So it says something, what's it say, that the Bodhisattva lives together with sentient beings as one should live with them. In other words, smoothly, politely, pleasantly, so that the Bodhisattva, to be with the Bodhisattva is a sort of delight. You know, there are some people like that, aren't there? That they just feel good when they're around because of the way they are. They're always sort of positive. They're always sort of sensitive in their communication. So the Bodhisattva, the ideal Bodhisattva, is like that. Tuning into people and avoiding causing them pain or suffering unnecessarily. And if pain or suffering inevitably has to be brought to them, doing it in a way that is most easy for them to digest and move on from. This is the Bodhisattva. There's quite a bit about mental compliance. There's a whole page here. I'm not going to go through it in detail. But it's all to do with when you say something difficult, when you don't say something difficult, and so on and so forth. What you say to people, if you've got something difficult to say to people, don't say it in a situation that will humiliate them. Don't say it in front of enemies. If you do say it in front of anybody, if it has to be said in front of anybody, say it in front of friends who will help them, and so on. Make sure that people are not socially humiliated, because that can sometimes have a very, very big effect, especially in a more traditional context. I think I'm not going to sort of labour all the points within this category. You get the essential point that you learn to tune in to people. It's a big lesson in life to recognise that people are not all like you. It took me quite a while to work that out, that other people work quite differently to me. And they may be, from my point of view, stupid and feeble and so forth, but actually probably they're pretty good in areas where I'm not very good, if you see what I mean. People are different, and one needs to learn to tune in to all sorts and kinds of human beings and appreciate them for what they are. No two human beings are the same. The ability to sense the sort of essential individuality of each person is a marked skill the Bodhisattva needs to develop. It's more than a skill, isn't it? It's a faculty, almost. Of course, we talk quite a bit about this in Triratna, especially under the heading of communication. It's something that Sangharakshita taught us right from the start. I don't think communication exercises are much done nowadays, but when I first came along, we learnt communication exercises and did them on retreats. We even had communication workshops, weekends, where we do communication exercises, where Sangharakshita sort of trained us in tuning in to each other, beyond all the differences, the superficial differences, learning to pick up on each other beyond words. The deepest communication is nonverbal, he teaches us, doesn't he? It's a very, very important part of our practice in our community to learn to tune in to each other. And I'm sure it's as alive as it ever has been. And it's one of the greatest skills of the Bodhisattva. You learn to pick up other people and to see things from their perspective, to see their particular qualities, see how the world works for them, and therefore how to respond to them in the most helpful way, the way that really takes them forward. Okay. Eighth quality, eighth mode. Yes, it's very interesting, actually. There's a little bit more that's worth commenting on. The Bodhisattva who complies with the expectations of others, who empathizes with others, who tunes into others, does not fail to cultivate others. In other words, tries to create connections with others in accordance with their particular characters and natures. But he doesn't cultivate others excessively. Have you ever been cultivated excessively? It's unbearable, isn't it? Where somebody sort of almost forces themselves upon you. It's what gives missionary a bad name. Being cultivated without any regard to yourself, if you see what I mean. You're being cultivated as a number, as a statistic, or for the other person's sake, so they've got another scalp, so to speak. Doesn't cultivate them unseasonably. You know, when somebody wants to be alone, don't force yourself upon them. It's important also to be on your own. And a bodhisattva is sensitive in that sort of way. It doesn't beg continually. doesn't make those appeals, those financial appeals, all the time. He knows the proper measure to be taken and does not ignore an invitation to food, drink, and the like. this is particularly pertinent in a more traditional Buddhist culture, where one of the ways in which you make connection with people is going to their homes. I'm always being invited to people's houses, and one's enjoined to try not to refuse. One does try to refuse, otherwise one would hardly be able to maneuver one's belly around the world. But you know, when you eat with people, you create a connection with them. They're feeding you, which is an act of gratitude, an act of connection, and you eat as an act of connection, believe it or not. I'm only doing it to create a connection. And excuses himself in the right way, so that if you genuinely can't go, you're already going somewhere else, you find the right way of doing it, so the person doesn't feel you're rejecting them. This is particularly important in a more traditional culture, where the refusal of a gift or an invitation can alienate people very strongly. So you have to find the right way of doing it. So you get the impression of this bodhisattva as being a really good communicator, a very effective presence in society, aware of social convention, not contravening social convention unnecessarily. If a convention is in a matter of indifference, then following it. Of course, if convention means doing something unskillful, then you don't do it. But where convention is a matter of indifference, flowing along with it. Anybody who's been in another culture will know this, that things are done differently. Well, fit in, accommodate it. If it's something wrong, well, don't do it. But if you don't do it, do it in a smooth and confrontative way as is appropriate. So appropriate behavior. Okay. Furthermore, the bodhisattva with the ethics of applauding genuine good qualities applauds sentient beings, applauds those endowed with the quality of faith by discussing the quality of faith. Do you see what I mean? So that if you take somebody's virtues and you praise those virtues, so that in a sense they are praised. Sometimes if you praise them too directly, it causes them embarrassment. So you sort of praise indirectly. Again, this wonderfully sensitive, caring way of operating. Etc. He applauds those endowed with the quality of wisdom by discussing the quality of wisdom. So you find a way of praising people that doesn't cause them embarrassment, doesn't cause them to become big-headed, doesn't cause others to be jealous. But You see in every being, this is essentially what lies behind it, their sort of good qualities, their particular qualities, even if those qualities are not especially developed. I've often mentioned a wonderful passage in the Pali Canon, where the Buddha is sitting with a number of disciples, and a number of his leading disciples come into the gathering. And as each one comes, he said, "Ah, here comes Shariputra. He is foremost for wisdom. Here comes Moggallana. He is foremost for psychic powers. Here it comes Ananda. He is foremost for hearing and remembering." And so on. He goes through all the disciples. I'm particularly fond of this because Subhuti also figures there. At least there's a connection in name. And Subhuti is foremost for two things, which is quite interesting. Foremost for friendliness. foremost for dwelling in solitude. Quite interesting, isn't it? Friendliness and dwelling in solitude. But anyway, I remember those two particularly for obvious reasons. Something to live up to. But the Buddha notices each of his disciples and praises him for his special or her special qualities. And I think this is an illustration of this particular capacity. The Buddha sees people's qualities and rejoices in them. The Bodhisattva sees people's good actions, their good mental states, and rejoices in them. Rejoices in them publicly, in a seemly way, in an appropriate way, so that that quality is enhanced in them and that quality is enhanced in the community. So the rejoicing in merits is one of the Bodhisattva's modes of benefiting living beings. Because, of course, when you applaud, when you rejoice in merits, you strengthen those merits. You strengthen those qualities in the awareness of everybody who's hearing you. You can see that sometimes that when there is a session of really well done rejoicing in merits, Jnana Varcha is particularly good at rejoicing in merits. When somebody does rejoicing in merits really well, you feel uplifted and you feel a response to those qualities. When it's done badly, and I've seen it done very badly, where there's just a sort of formulaic list, you know, somebody's got to rejoice in merits because that's their job at the end of the program, and they go through a list and it really falls flat. And of course, let's rejoice in X's merits for hastily turning over pieces of paper to come to what they've done. It doesn't quite sing. But if it's done really well, it's really enhancing. It's Kushala Dharma Bhavana. It's the development of good qualities. And I think it's actually something that anybody trying to operate as part of this community that we have around the LBC should be trying to develop the skill of rejoicing in merits. It's a particularly necessary one because the highest skill that we're supposed to be developing in general society is criticism. The cynical is the most sort of applauded quality. Sometimes when you hear political satire, some of it's, you know, in a way revealing of something about the climate of things, but often it's so unpleasantly cynical, just pointing to faults, pointing to failings. And it's very, very rare, for instance, that you hear a politician of one stripe praising politicians of another. And surely, in the end, they've got pretty much the same policies when it comes down to it. Surely there could be moments when we can praise each other, even if we disagree about some things. But the climate of the times is towards criticism and debunking and denigrating. we could do with a really healthy dose of genuine, heartfelt rejoicing in merits. I think this is one of our functions as a community, is to inject into the culture the quality of rejoicing in merits. So I think we could all do with quite a bit of practice, learning from those who are good at it and learning to do it ourselves. Of course, to do it, you have to feel it. You can't just dredge up a good quality because you're supposed to do it. You've got to really feel it. So you've got to be looking for those good qualities and learning to see them immediately and dampening down your tendency, if you have it, to pick out the faults and the failings. The sort of culture that I come from, grumbling and denigration is almost second nature. Finding fault is second nature. I remember after a cocktail party, people would sort of sit around and slag off everybody else who'd been there, which I found rather shocking at the time, because they'd been so nice during the party, all smiles and compliments. But when it's over, out come the knives, the ching, 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 the claws come out. So we shouldn't have that amongst us. We need to work against that tendency if we have it. So applauding, it's more than just speaking well of other people. It's bringing good qualities into the public sphere so that they live and are honoured and rejoiced in, respected, made much of. Of course, not shallowly, not in a way sort of almost reverse cynically, not sentimentally. One of Bhante's aphorisms is that sentimentality is more emotion than you really feel. Cynicism is less emotion than you really feel. Do you see what I mean? With sentiment, you blow your emotional responses out of proportion. Oh, how wonderful, darling, and so forth and so on. Cynicism is where you feel something and then you mock it. And you undermine it. And I'm afraid it's a terrible habit in certain quarters of British society. And then it becomes a whole style of humour that is public humour. So yes, the Bodhisattva is applauds, learns to applaud, but don't get carried away. Furthermore, the Bodhisattva, with the ethics of suppression, puts a stop to sentient beings. This takes some digesting, doesn't it? Puts a stop to sentient beings. Minor fault and minor transgression, he rebukes with mild rebuke, and so forth. But his attitude is gentle and free from bad feeling. This is something that probably most of us should leave to much more experienced bodhisattvas. Most of us shouldn't go there. We need to do much more work on the applauding and the empathizing and so forth. But at times, it is necessary to stop things. The Buddha was particularly good at this. You get at times him entering into communication with somebody, the person starts to criticize the Buddha, and the Buddha sort of takes off his Clark Kent uniform and suit, and is revealed in his Superman kit, and he just gives it to them. I remember when I first sort of came across this, because I'd got a rather sentimentalized view of what the Buddha was like, he just really gives it to them with both barrels. Sometimes a choice of words might be something like, "You foolish, stupid person who have no idea what they're talking about." That's the Buddha. What's really interesting, at least as it's presented in the text, is the person gets it. He knows how to rebuke. It's one of the most difficult tasks that can be, because he's not actually emotionally involved in it. Do you know what I mean? He's not rebuking because he hates or he's angry or he's upset or, you know, he feels hurt. It's nothing to do with it. He just sees that in this situation, the only thing that will do is absolute directness, is speaking fully and directly to the person in a way that just stops them in their tracks. I've seen this happen one or two times. I'm not going to tell you the circumstances, but I've seen this happen once or twice. I've tried to do it and failed miserably and actually just got my own negativity mixed up in it. So I try to avoid this as much as I can. But sometimes I've seen people who are much more skillful than me really pull somebody up. Just stop that. It's not going to help you. It's not going to help anybody else. Really showing people where the ethical line is. Restraining somebody when they're doing something that's going to be really bad for them. Pulling them back from harmful activity. When I've seen it, it's awe-inspiring. What I've seen is somebody, in fact, our teacher, sort of very, very calm, and then suddenly speak with a sort of force, a strength that was just not apparent in the moment before. And somebody's just stopped in their tracks and really sees, yes, you are right. And then it's gone. There's no lingering hatred. There's no lingering unpleasantness. It's just gone. But really be careful, because this can be a rationalization merely for one's own upsetness. You can only do this if you have no emotional stake in it. Do you see what I mean? If your own mind must be entirely still tuned in to that other person. But you see, the only way to get them to see what they're doing is this sort of absolute bluntness. I'm mentioning it because it's in the list. I almost hesitate to mention it because it can be so easily misunderstood, both in the sense of sort of people then thinking that the Buddha or the Bodhisattva is not really a real Buddha or Bodhisattva, that this is an element that shouldn't be there. So it can distort one's image. On the other hand, it can be used as a rationalization. I'm just doing this as a Bodhisattva. Bang. I don't think it's like that. There are just times when somebody really needs to hear the truth. They need to hear it unadorned, forcibly, strongly, clearly expressed. And you need to have tremendous skill to do that. You need to know that it will get through. You need, therefore, to be really deeply tuned in to the other. So I hope I put enough caveats in here. There are a number of occasions in the scriptures where the Buddha exercises this mode of communication. And as I say, it's always successful. My sense is that if he knew it wouldn't be successful, he just wouldn't do it. There's occasion when he... No, I won't go into it. But the point is that sometimes people need to be stopped. And I'm sure on one's own level, one knows sometimes that it's necessary to sort of speak strongly or very bluntly. But it's very difficult to do that without some personal element in it, often with one's own frustration revealing itself. Bodhisattva doesn't do that. And the signs of that are that there's no build-up. There's no sort of sense that the bodhisattva is carrying something or harbouring something. And when it happens, there's a sense it's absolutely clean. And when it's over, it's gone. And I've seen it happen in situations where, you know, afterwards, Bhante and the other person are able to speak very, very warmly together. It's been done so cleanly. Anyway, there you are. Please don't say, Subhuti said it's all right to get really shirty. And please don't say when Subhuti gets shirty, he's being a bodhisattva, because very often he's not, to be honest. But there is that need sometimes to put a stop to things. So, lastly, most wonderfully, the bodhisattva desires to frighten sentient beings and to bend them to his will by the power of working wonders. He takes those sentient beings who course in misbehavior and shows them at close range that the ripened fruits of misbehavior are the states of woe, the hells. Now, I'm a little suspicious of these sort of passages, because they remind one of, you know, hellfire preaching, if you see what I mean. Anybody who's read James Joyce's The Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, there's an occasion when the artist is listening to a sermon which is all about hell and scares the life out of him, really terrifies him. So immediately he goes out and goes to a brothel, because it's the only thing you can do in relation to that, if you see what I mean, is a reaction. And sometimes in Buddhist tradition, one sees something that comes close to this sort of hellfire preaching. I think what really is meant is showing the nature of karma, showing that actions have consequences, showing that if you act unskillfully, it will lead to an unfortunate or unpleasant experience for you. If you act skillfully, it will unfold in a pleasant way for you. Doesn't mean nothing nasty will ever happen, but that you'll be able to deal with it, to surmount it. So I think when the bodhisattva is spoken of as using his wonder-working power to frighten sentient beings, I think that gets the wrong tone, so to speak. I think what it is that the bodhisattva really reveals the nature of karma, really reveals the full extent of reality, really shows how things work. There's a story in the Divyavadana, which is a very important Mahayana text we don't know much about, which is probably the best known of Buddhist texts in the Mahayana world in the Middle Ages. And it's the basis for the frieze, the reliefs at Borobudur, the sculptures at Borobudur, the Indonesian stupa. They're based upon stories from the Divyavadana. But one of the stories in the Divyavadana is about the origin of the Wheel of Life, which is quite interesting. It's said that Modgalyayana had the psychic power of visiting all the realms of existence. And he used to talk to his fellow monks and nuns about his experiences in all the realms of existence. And sometimes he could, so to speak, take people there, presumably in imagination, or maybe not in imagination. But through communication with Modgalyayana, you could find yourself in heaven. You could find yourself in hell. You could find yourself among the hungry ghosts or in the realm of the animals. He could somehow help you to see things in all those different terms. And the Buddha noticed that when people had been talking to Modgalyayana about such things, they were much more motivated. They had a sense of urgency. They practiced much more uncompromisingly, rigorously, vigorously. So the Buddha suggested to the Mogilyan that he should instruct an artist. In some accounts, he actually himself drew it out with grains of rice. He drew it out with grains of rice. He made the sort of model of the Wheel of Life with grains of rice. And then he said that an artist should talk to Mogilyana and place a Wheel of Life over the gates of the monastery. That's why in the Tibetan world, all monasteries have just inside the entrance to the temple a Wheel of Life. And I think we should probably follow this practice in one way or another, so that you're immediately confronted with a full range of existence and you can see it vividly, and you can see what the consequences are of actions in all directions. So that's what I think is implied here, that the Bodhisattva is able to show people imaginatively the whole scope of existence. He's able to show them what conditioned existence is really like. And this is what we try to do in our beginner's courses, isn't it? When we take people through the Wheel of Life, I don't know whether we still do it, no doubt we do. We're trying to show them what reality is, the full range and possibility of reality, and how it will play out in dependence upon your actions. So the Bodhisattva shows people the whole of reality, so they're motivated to act skillfully within it and ultimately to get out of it. So yes, the Bodhisattva invigorates beings, let's put it like that, rather than frightens, because that sounds a bit too like that priest in Dublin in James Joyce's account, or the hellfire preacher of the deep south of America. He also is able to deal with a difficult situation when he's talking in front of an assembly and somebody starts to give him a hard time. He's able, so to speak, to silence them, not just through the force of his argument, but, so to speak, through bringing a much larger picture into play. He's able to silence the cynical by awakening the imagination. I think this is what this is all about. It's all put in terms of magical powers, and he may be able to conjure up an image or whatever. Maybe it does mean that at times. I've never actually seen it myself, but I don't exclude the possibility of it. But the Bodhisattva is able to bring the imagination to life so that people see a much vaster picture, and their cynicism, their lack of faith is just overwhelmed. They see something far larger, far greater. The nearest I've seen to this, or rather the fullest expression of this I've seen, is Sangharakshita Bhante. In some of those lecture series, the two that really stand out in my mind, ones I was present for, were the Sutra of Golden Light. I remember Bhante gave that series of lectures in the town hall in Hampstead, and in those rather sort of grand but cold civic set, that rather grand but cold civic setting, he made the sutra come to life. And one could at times sort of see, I don't mean literally see, one could feel the spiritual presences he was talking all around us, sort of colour and light came into the room. I could sort of see his body glowing as he talked about these other dimensions that the sutra explores. I remember the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, even more actually, that series of talks. What is it? The Inconceivable Emancipation. Gave that series in Old Street in what was the East West Centre. I don't know whether it's still there. The town hall still is there, still glowing. But the East-West Centre probably is gone and is replaced by an office block. But, you know, rather run-down old-school building, institutional building. We would gather once a week and Bhante would expound the sutra. And you've got the lectures, which are remarkable. Don't just read them, listen to them. That something comes through when you listen to them. Not the whole force of what it was like to be present, which unfortunately is irreproducible. But I was there. I saw it. And week after week after week, Bhante would just make a vast, vast vision come to life. I'm unfortunately, or fortunately, not a visionary. I don't see things. But I feel things. And he's able to make something come into the imagination that was infinitely beyond anything I'd ever experienced before. That is the function of the Bodhisattva, to make the Dhamma live, to bring imagination to life so that you see it, you feel it as a living reality all around you, so that your petty, petty concerns are just completely overwhelmed. That is the function of the Bodhisattva. To try to bring imagination to life, the highest imagination. There you are. These are the 11 modes that we need to be practicing, and we can only do so together. I hope I've made that point sufficiently clear. Individually, we cannot produce even a fraction of one of these, but collectively, we can allow the Bodhisattva to emerge amongst us. So I hope that through exploring this this text, or at least a tiny portion of this text, I've given you some sense of what we need to do, and in fact what we are doing. And I hope that it will enliven your own practice. And I hope that it's a fitting way to launch inauguration of this retreat centre, and that this we can see that these 11 modes are what have produced this retreat centre and what it is a vehicle for in the future. And we've also explored at least a tiny part of one of the most important texts of early Buddhism after the Buddha himself. And we've sort of got to encounter a very great bodhisattva who launched this tradition, who, through this text, the next part of the text, starts to go through the bodhisattva vows and how those vows are taken. Those vows that came to Dada Rinpoche, who is now a portion of his relics, are now in the stupa there, and from Dada Rinpoche came to our own teacher, Bhante, and that he has now sort of embodied in our movement, in our order and our community. So I hope that you've got some sense of the background and the history of who we are and what we're doing. And I'm sorry not to have been able to participate much more fully in the retreat. I've had to conserve my energies. I've managed pretty well, and I think day by day I've got stronger, and I'm hoping that I'll get stronger still. Thank you very much.